From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, West Michigan GOP Congressman Fred Upton on the House tax reform bill.
I'm trying to make sure that it is really targeted towards the middle class. I guess that's my number one concern.
He's one of the few juvenile lifers to be released in Michigan, and now he's a college student.
It was only a dream and fantasy while being incarcerated to be able to attend a major university.
Heroes to Hives, an Army vet, helps other vets learn the art of beekeeping and more.
There's healing happening in that bee yard. It's not just beekeeping.
And the Mott Campus Clowns using humor and magic to take on bullies.
Over a 7.5 week period, they transformed themselves from regular college students to members of a clown troupe, making a difference in the world about the topic of bullying.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. And now the news. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's program, an ex-juvenile lifer talks college, forgiveness, and second chances.
It took time. I was able to forgive myself. I was able to seek the forgiveness of the person that I killed and want to have that conversation with my victim's family.
But first, House Republicans are positioning their sweeping tax bill for a planned floor vote next week. Senate Republicans are set to unveil their tax bill today. The GOP goal? Get a unified bill on President Trump's desk by the end of this year. With us now is Republican Congressman Fred Upton of Southwest Michigan. Congressman, would you vote for the House tax bill as it is now?
Well, of course, as we chat, the bill is still in committee. We're going to see what the final bill looks like. I'm going to have a chance to read it and listen to the different concerns. I'm home this weekend and will be meeting with a number of different folks. But, you know, the basic principles are certainly something that I support. It really is aimed for the middle class. It doubles the standard deduction. It's going to lower, the estimates are, at least the way that it is now, it's going to lower the number of folks that itemize their return from about 30% to about 10%. So that's a pretty big reduction. Provides real relief, particularly to small businesses, in what's called the pass-through, down to 25%. It makes us more competitive with the rest of the world. And I know over here on the west side of the state, we've lost a good number of companies to overseas because their tax rate is lower. So this makes it more competitive. And, you know, we're early in the process. The committee, House Ways and Means Committee, is expected later today to actually finish their version. They're still doing changes and undertaking amendments as we speak now. It'll be on the floor next week. Don't know. Traditionally, a tax bill does not have amendments that are allowed on the floor. You have a substitute that's offered by both, by the Democrats will be able to offer a substitute. And of course, the Senate bill is going to be different than the House bill on a number of different fronts. And should they pass their bill, the goal is for both of these bills to pass prior to Thanksgiving. They'll be different, and there'll be a lot of changes. This bill will go to conference, and we'll see it come back. And as you said in your opening, the goal is to get it done before Christmas and to be effective in January 1st of 2018.
As you get these early indications of what's in the House bill, what gives you the most pause or concern?
Well, as I think about it, I'm trying to make sure that it is really targeted towards the middle class. I guess that's my number one concern. There was a concern about a week ago, and I weighed in with the Ways and Means Committee and with our leadership, and frankly with the White House as well. There was a move afoot to change the 401ks. These, of course, have been investment retirement abilities that people have to put into a retirement fund at a lower, or not pay the tax on it until you actually retire, which is usually a lower rate later on versus what it is when you're working. There was a move afoot to change that, to alter it in a major way. I certainly heard from people in my district and weighed in. And I'm glad to say that at least as of now, there are no changes to the 401k. For me, I've always supported every effort for people to save for the future. So that was a bullet that we were able to avoid, at least at this point, by reducing the tax rates from 7 to 3 or 4. maintaining the upper tax rate at 39.6 for those making more than $1 million. I think that was a fair compromise and certainly one that I can support. But I'll tell you, you know, I was a participant in a small business forum at Western Michigan University a few months ago. The issue that virtually every small business had, men and women that were running small businesses there, was the cost of capital. By being able to reduce that tax rate to what is likely going to be no higher than 25% is a huge win for small businesses. They've been the engine of economic growth, and I think one where we can really move forward and particularly help us here in Michigan.
You know, Congressman, right now the bill doesn't change the tax rate on income of over $1 million. It stands at 39.6%, and you've got the conservative group Club for Growth, and they want the bill changed. They want to cut that rate for people who make over $1 million, and they're demanding the bill be changed to make it easier for businesses to claim a lower 25% income tax rate, and they want to speed up repeal of the estate tax. So the question is, are wealthier taxpayers and businesses getting a big enough break in this proposal, in your view?
You know, I know the Club for Growth has called for reducing that rate of 39.6, but remember, this is always aimed at middle-class taxpayers. So I'm comfortable with keeping that rate at those that earn more than $1 million at 39.6. I know that this, I mean, one of the big issues here on this tax bill is it is going to increase the deficit. The budget that we passed in the House and the Senate called for $1.5 trillion over a 10-year span of increasing the deficit. And in my view, our economy is so fragile that I can accept that, knowing that, in fact, at the end of the day, at the end of the 10 years, I happen to believe that we're going to create more jobs, we're going to bring back more investment from overseas, and it will more than make up for the immediate hit on the deficit by coming back with a fairer, simpler plan that really is targeted towards the middle class versus the high income folks who, frankly, can afford a 39.6% rate.
I'm kind of hearing you don't agree that wealthier taxpayers and businesses are getting a big enough break. You're feeling that
no,
they're...
I think that it is a fair balance here.
Okay.
I really do. And I know that the...
But could more be done, do you think, for the middle and low-income families?
This is, you know, we're doubling the standard deduction, which is a huge benefit for those in the middle-class area income. We're looking at a child tax credit expansion as well that's going to be in the House bill. Again, we don't know how this is going to end up in the final package because there will be differences between the House and the Senate. But at the end of the day, we're going to have a lot of Americans that literally can file their taxes on a postcard, I think to do exactly what many Republicans said over the last number of years. We haven't reformed the tax code in more than 30 years. It was 1986. It was President Reagan. Not a lot of folks. I wasn't in Congress back then, but that's a long time ago. And now you see these pictures of what the tax code looks like. There was a couple pictures here online in New York Times and other papers. The tax code literally is about 2.5 feet tall when it's stacked up in these books. The new tax code is only a couple inches long. It is way too complex. Folks have found lots of loopholes to avoid paying taxes. And, you know, right now, they say that the heels of the Gucci Gulch, you got every tax lobbyist looking to try and preserve their little tax loophole that's there. To have a standard rate by eliminating a lot of these loopholes and lowering taxes, particularly aimed at the middle class, is a pretty good vote in my estimation.
But as this is being shaped, could more be done for these low and middle income families? I mean, what changes would you propose?
The one thing you have to remember is, we are governed by what the budget did a couple weeks ago when we passed it in the House and the Senate. We are only allowed to cut taxes by $1.5 trillion. You cannot exceed that. So if you add another benefit here or create another loophole, you've got to take it out of probably increasing the rate on something else. And that's why you got to have a balance. And my sense is that at the end of the day, again, the House bill is going to be different than the Senate bill. At the end of the day, I think that we'll reach a compromise between the House and the Senate and be able to get it to the president to see meaningful tax reform for the first time in more than 30 years.
could you get a better bill by working with the Democrats?
Well, remember, I'm not on the committee. I've always been bipartisan in everything that I've done. And, you know, traditionally, you know, at the end of the day, I think that there will be a number of Democrats that vote for the final package, but not in the first round. It's not likely in either the House or the Senate. But I think at the end of the day, that final tax bill, if we get it to the president about Christmas time, there'll be a number of Democrats in both the House and the Senate that will vote for the final bill.
Your colleague in the House, New York Republican Chris Collins, made some big headlines this week when he said that his donors told him, pass the tax bill or never call them again. What are you hearing from your donors?
Well, I is one that goes home virtually every week, and I'll be home later today. I have heard from a good number of folks that are adding their voices to, you know, you all said that you do tax reform, better get it done. We are, you know, we lost our largest employer over in Allegan County. They moved their headquarters to Ireland. Why? They've got a lower tax rate. You see that time and time again. I mean, in a lot of different campaigns over the last number of years, you hear from just about everybody, you know, let's take away the incentives for companies to move overseas. This bill does that. This bill does that. And by allowing that income earned overseas to come back home to be invested here in bricks and mortar and job creation. And I've heard from a lot of companies in our side of the state that, in fact, will bring those dollars home, will create more manufacturing jobs here, put more people to work, and create the type of world-class environment and quality of life that we want.
West Michigan Republican Congressman Fred Upton. As always, thank you so much, Congressman, for speaking with us.
It's always Fred. Thank you.
And on our next stateside, we get Democratic Congressman Dan Kildee's take on the GOP tax plan.
We can't ignore the lessons of history. Tax cuts do not create the kind of economic activity that creates the revenue to offset the cuts, unless you're talking about a Kennedy era or a Reagan era kind of cut, and we're not in that environment any longer.
That's tomorrow on Stateside. Coming up, we learn about a unique Michigan State University program training veterans in beekeeping, plus a college class turning students into clowns in order to spread a message of anti-bullying. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Experimentation.
Vision.
The next idea.
People mean very different things whenever they talk about innovation.
Bullying in Michigan and all around the country is a serious problem, one that parents, educators, and others are striving to solve. One Michigan college is offering a unique and funny approach to this serious problem. Mott Community College's Honors College is home to a group of students who transform themselves into clowns, reaching out to school kids with an anti-bullying message. Our guest today on The Next Idea directs Mott's Honors College, and he's the founder of the Mott Campus Clowns. Brian Ivory, welcome to The Next Idea.
Thank you, Cindy.
So besides heading up the Honors College, you've had this lifelong interest in the art of clowning. Tell us a little about that history of yours.
Well, I went to volunteer for the Special Olympics when I was a student at Michigan State University, and they were looking for someone to help organize entertainment for Special Olympians, and my hand went up, and the person running the meeting simply said, Bubbles the Clown, that has a nice ring to it. So I thought it was my mission to organize students to be clowns for Special Olympians.
And so you come to Mott, you're heading the Honors College. What gave you the idea for this group, the Mott Campus Clowns?
Well, we teach a class called Social Diversity and Civic Engagement, and the students are required to do 30 to 45 hours of community service. And I remembered my days at Michigan State where students had such a great experience as clowns, and it was only a matter of time that I decided that I would try that at Mott Community College, and it's now called the Mott Campus Clowns.
And your group tours all over Michigan, bringing this anti-bullying message to whom? Where do you go?
Primarily, our audience is our elementary school children, as well as members of Boys and Girls Clubs.
So walk us through the process of your students becoming clowns for this service project. So we all understand these are all students in Mott's Honors Program.
That is true.
And there is much more to becoming a clown than outsiders might think, right? Almost a transformation of sorts?
Absolutely.
Tell us about that.
Well, they start the first day of class learning about the history of clowning and the rich tradition that goes with it. They learn how to apply makeup, they learn how to tell jokes, how to interact with the public, take photographs, but most importantly, they train for our show, which is called Turning Frowns Upside Down, One Smile at a Time. And over a 7.5 week period, they transform themselves from regular college students to members of a clown troupe, making a difference in the world about the topic of bullying.
So give me an idea of what's in the presentation. What's in the show that you bring to kids around Michigan?
It's actually an anti-bullying comedy magic show. So we mix both comedy skits along with an anti-bully message. And SMILE actually is an acronym for the action steps that students can take to stop or prevent bullying. For example, I stands for informed adult. If you see bullying and your words or actions don't stop the bullying, think of an adult you can go to and then say out loud, I'm going to tell Ms. Johnson, and do so immediately. It's not fibbing if it keeps a classmate from being bullied.
So you're giving them very easy to understand action steps in a way that's fun. Although I'm going to say, and you know this because you're a clown, some people are scared by clowns. How do the Mott Campus Clowns address that?
Well, we train students to interact with folks who may be shy about clowns or afraid of clowns. There's only about 2% of the American public are actually afraid of clowns. And when you interact with them in the public, they just simply leave the area. That's much different from the teenager who's acting afraid to impress their friends.
Got it. Why anti-bullying? Is this coming from a personal place for you?
Yeah, I remember back, my favorite sport is baseball, and I remember one season just being ruined by one of my teammates who bullied me each and every game, each and every practice. And I remembered how that made me feel. It made me feel small. It made me feel as if I wasn't welcomed. And so if I have a history with bullying, I can probably pinpoint it to that experience.
How do you see the humor aspect getting that message across to kids? What do you see in those classrooms in those schools when you're there?
Well, it's a nice contrast. Obviously, bullying is a very serious issue, and we bring humor to that issue, so it engages the students. We keep their attention for an hour and 10 minutes for our anti-bully show, and part of the way we do that is through humor.
What kind of dynamics do you see in among the group of kids watching you?
Well, I'll give you an example. Last fall, there was the scary clown craze sweeping across America, and my clown troupe had 6 shows that were canceled. And at our first show, I told my students, I don't know how this audience is going to act. Let's just play it by ear. And when I sent them into the audience, into the aisles, about 50 students leaped up from their chairs and hugged 2 of my clowns, Propeller and Puddin'. And at that moment, I realized the issues of people being afraid of clowns is more in adults than it is with children.
Interesting. How have you seen the experience of learning to clown and then bringing this anti-bully message to children? How is this impacting your students?
My students experience being a clown and serving the community in a really unique way for a very important mission. And the rewards they get out of that experience, even though it's a lot of hard work and dedication, it just expands their hearts, it expands their life experiences, and expands their commitment to wanting to make a difference in the world.
I've got to wonder, have any of the students decided, you know what, I want to do clowning for my life's work? Has this opened up any career doors for people?
Yes, I actually have many students who continue clowning and want to stay involved with the Mott Campus Clowns, and we let them do that by joining us at the Detroit Thanksgiving Day Parade and also over the summertime with the Michigan Special Olympics.
So are you going to be in the parade in Detroit on Thanksgiving Day?
Yep, the Mott Campus Clowns will be present in the Thanksgiving Day Parade this coming Thanksgiving.
So everybody should watch for that. How would you like to see this expand, Brian? I mean, do you see yourself maybe founding more clowning groups around the state, or what do you see?
Well, I'm trying to get this model down first. I'm in my 6th year, and it would be nice at some point to expand what I've learned and to share it with others and to try and get a movement afoot, if you will.
Well, any schools or any boys and girls groups who want to have the Mott Campus Clowns bring a show to them can just go to Facebook, because the Mott Campus Clowns have a Facebook page, so it's easy to reach out through Facebook. Brian Ivory is director of the Mott Honors College and is Dr. Bubby, right? Dr. Bubby?
Yep, Dr. Bubby.
founder and member of the Mott Campus Clowns. Thank you so much for being a part of The Next Idea.
Thank you, Cindy, and thank you, Michigan NPR.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Have you ever thought of a bee as a healer? Well, if you haven't, you will after meeting my next guest. Adam Mingrao was serving in the U.S. Army until his career was ended by an injury. After his discharge, which he didn't really want, he somehow landed on beekeeping and found tending hives was powerful. It was healing. Today, Adam is working on his doctorate in entomology at Michigan State University. And he's helping other vets discover the healing power of bees and beekeeping by founding a program he calls Heroes to Hives. We spoke at the Kellogg Center Auditorium the evening of November 2nd. Here's our conversation.
Thank you, Cynthia.
So, why bees? How did you first discover that there, you know, this passion for them?
You know, it really happened when I was an undergraduate at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo. My first year there as a freshman, I took a beekeeping class, an intro to beekeeping class. And I was during a period where I was transitioning from the military and dealing with a lot of the same challenges that our military personnel deal with when they are transitioning, which are things like a loss of camaraderie, coming to terms with disabilities. And those were things that were plaguing me a lot as I came out of the military. But what I found in that first beekeeping class at Cal Poly was the time that was in the bee yard spent with the bees, I wasn't thinking about all of those things. I was thinking about what was happening right there, right then, really being present. And I found that beekeeping really was more of a meditative practice than anything. When you're working with bees, if any of you have had the opportunity to do that, one of the things that we always think about with bees is being stung. And actually, bees are pretty docile. And when you work them correctly and you're in the moment with them at that point in time, taking your time, being gentle, being calm, the bees really don't react to you very much. But when you get out of that space and you're not present with those bees at that moment, maybe you're thinking about, you know, that time in Fallujah or a time in Helmand province, then those bees, because you're not in that moment, you become sloppy, those bees are going to remind you you're not in that moment. And it's almost like a mindfulness bell, but it's in the form of a bee sting. And so so bees will naturally remind you that you're not in the moment, you're not being present. And so really that, for me, was something that really was a conduit for healing. And I saw that as a potential conduit for other veterans as well.
And thus, you've founded this Heroes to Hives program. I know, working with the Michigan Pollinator Initiative. Mm-hmm. So what do you do in Heroes to Hives?
So really what we do is we create a safe educational space for veterans. It's all veterans and their spouses, so we have a closed education format, and those veterans go through an entire season of beekeeping together. And so during that period, we're learning basic biology of bees, we're learning management of honeybees, and you know, we're talking about these things as we're working live hives at our apiary down at Kellogg Biological Station. But over the period of time, while we're working together as veterans, you see some blossoming happening. You see these veterans who have oftentimes felt isolated because they're not part of that cohort that they were with in the military, all of a sudden find a new family in these other veterans that are part of this beekeeping program. And so what we see as we move through the program is we're going through all the biologies, we're going through all the management strategies. They get this great beekeeping education, but they also are left with a cohort of individuals that they can call upon and that they see as family again. And so when we do our evaluations, we just actually went through a series of evaluations with our students from this year. The biggest thing that we see that those individuals get out of this program, of course, the management things, but it's the sense of camaraderie again. It's the sense of feeling like I'm part of a unit again. And then it's also this new sense of having a new mission almost. You know, we're working with the most important insect on the planet. And these individuals that come out of the military, we don't join the military because we don't like doing things. We join the military because we are motivated and we're individuals that want to make a difference. And so being able to give other veterans the opportunity to be part of the challenge of saving the most important insect on the planet, boy, that's a great mission to give somebody that has that military mindset.
It is a win-win. It's win for the bees, win for the veterans. And I keep thinking of that line from Shakespeare, "We happy few, we band of brothers."
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing that probably hurts so much when you have to separate and come back to civilian life.
Absolutely. When I discharged from the military, I joined the military expecting to retire from the military.
And did you join after 9/11?
I did join after 9/11. I'm a fourth generation Army soldier, and really my family history of the military has been in response to catastrophic events. World War I, World War II, Vietnam, and the post 9/11 era is really where my family has served. And when 9/11 happened, there was no doubt that it was my turn to go in. And going in, you know, that's what I anticipated to do, was make that a career. And one of the things that you have to realize when you're in the military is things don't always go the way you anticipate. And that discharge from the military after being injured was tough to deal with. Probably the hardest thing, and something that I wrestle with even to this day, is the guilt associated with leaving my unit, leaving my brothers and sisters behind. And that's, you know, that camaraderie component, that sense of community that we at Heroes to Hives really drive to foster, that is something that is unique to veteran populations and really something that we see tremendous growth from with these individuals that we work with. And those conversations, like I spoke about, that happen in the bee yard, they start about biology and bees, but they end, by the end of the season, we're talking about, you know, some things that, to be quite frank, are very difficult to hear. And there's healing happening in that bee yard. It's not just beekeeping.
And what do they do with the training afterwards? Do some of these vets go on and say, I'm in it, I'm going to become a beekeeper?
Absolutely. And the nice thing about the program is that we really try to format it for everybody. So we have individuals that were keeping bees before they started the program and are going to continue on to do that as part of their farm business. We have individuals that already own farms and maybe we're just looking to add a little diversity to the farm, maybe just get a few hives out on the farm. And then we even have one particular story, Tori Condit, who is an Air Force veteran. She actually is starting a meadery, so Star Thistle Meadery in Kalamazoo. She really came to Heroes to Hives to learn more about bees so that she could help support her business that, you know, really is taking advantage of knowing this knowledge and applying it actually to another, completely another industry.
Now, I know you and your wife, Lacey, have your farm bee-wise here in Lansing. So did you or anyone in your family, did you work in agriculture before you began this?
I did. So I grew up in a small community in Southern California that it was an agricultural community. It's now a probably part of L.A. sprawl more than anything. But when I grew up there, it was cherry trees, oranges, apple orchards, and I worked in those orchards. Actually, my first job was on a cherry orchard as a picker at 14 years old. And those memories, those experiences of working on farms as a kid, you know, they really instill hard work, a really good work ethic in you, and also really give you an understanding of the importance of agriculture in the world. And the fact of the matter is that, you know, Michigan farmers and farmers across the United States, we're feeding the world, and it's an important role to play. And pollinators, they play an important role in that also. You know, one out of every three bites of food you take is due to pollination. So bees are a very important part of that agricultural sector.
And I actually went to the Heroes to Hives Facebook page, and I see you've got some big things happening in 2018.
We do. We have some great things happening in 2018. The program last year, we saw one of the limitations was we only had one site. I had students that were driving from Cadillac all the way down to Hickory Corners for classes. And so what we're doing in 2018 is we're actually opening up six locations at different MSU Extension facilities, including a location in the UP at the North Farm. And we'll be doing beekeeping education at all of those locations across the state, reaching more veterans. And the other thing that we've opened up this year that is a learning experience from our next year that's a learning experience from last year is that spouses, military spouses, will also be included in all of those classes as well.
So people are going to be listening, going, I want to find out more. How do they do it?
If you want to find out more, heroes2hives.com will bring you to our MSU site. And if you'd like to donate, heroes2hives.org is our donation site. All donation funded, all private donors and corporate donors who keep this program going.
Well, Adam and Grayo, thank you for your service, first of all, and thank you for what you're doing in Heroes to Hives in working with vets and helping them heal the way you're doing it. Congratulations.
Thank you, Cynthia, so much. Thank you.
The case against a former Marine drill instructor accused of abusing recruits goes to the jury today. 8 Marines must decide whether Gunnery Sergeant Joseph Felix is guilty of physically and verbally abusing recruits, particularly singling out 3 Muslim recruits. Among the 3, 20-year-old Raheel Siddiqui of Taylor. The high school valedictorian died in March 2016 after a fall in his barracks. The coroner ruled his death a suicide, but Siddiqui's family insists that as a devout Muslim, he would never take his own life. The long list of charges against Felix include cruelty and maltreatment, failing to obey orders, making false official statements, obstruction of justice, and drunken and disorderly conduct. He is not accused of causing Siddiqui's death. The prosecutor argued that Gunnery Sergeant Joseph Felix, quote, wasn't making Marines, he was breaking Marines. Felix pleaded not guilty. He did not take the witness stand. Still to come, finally free after nearly 30 years in prison, one of Michigan's so-called juvenile lifers is going to college.
It was only a dream and fantasy while being incarcerated to be able to attend a major university.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Over 11,000 new students started classes this fall at Arizona State University. For one of those students, that start was something he once dreamed would never happen. That's because Antonio Espery is one of Michigan's 363 juvenile lifers. 30 years ago, when he was 16, Espery was arrested for killing a man. At age 17, he was sentenced to natural life in prison, no chance of parole. But thanks to a pair of U.S. Supreme Court rulings that declared mandatory life without parole sentences for teens under 18 was unconstitutional, Antonio Espery was released just this past spring. And now he's a student at Arizona State, and he is with us now. Antonio Espery, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
You're one of a small handful of juvenile lifers in Michigan who've been released so far. I'm wondering, what is it like to say to yourself, I'm going to college, I can do what I want, when I want, I can enroll in classes?
So it was only a dream and fantasy while being incarcerated to be able to attend a major university and be a part of the campus environment along with other college students. And I could never really picture it in terms of what it would be like physically. And all I did was just dream about that, you know, that time, that moment in which it could come, it can happen. So I lived through it through a dream.
Through a dream. And yes. And it is happening. You've got the Sun Devil's lanyard on. You've got the Sun Devil's T-shirt. I mean, you are just you've got your ID. The joy on your face is just radiating in every corner of this room. What classes are you going to take? What are your career and degree goals?
I am attending Arizona State University online. And the reason I'm going online is because you have to be a resident of Arizona or have been a resident for at least a year in order to meet the resident requirement. So online, I am taking justice studies, I am taking criminal law, and also I am taking the ASU experience. And my major is justice studies, and I'm a part of the School of Social Transformation. Yes.
And what do you want to do with that? What's your dream?
I would like to be a CEO of my own nonprofit organization, which works with at-risk youth or challenged youth and ex-offenders returning back to our society. I would like to be able to offer a particular skill set to be able to help them navigate through some of the hurdles, situations, or circumstances or barriers which they're confronted with day to day, and to be able to be that resource. You know, a lot of ex-offenders that return back to society do not have family support or cannot connect properly with resources already established within the state, or a state may lack resources.
So there's this big gap. And if anyone can look an ex-offender in the eye and say, I know what this is like, it's you.
Yes.
Tell us, it's such a big jump from nearly 3 decades in a prison cell to this man sitting before me talking about the courses he's taking and his career dreams. What happened all those years ago when you were a teenager that landed you in prison for all that time?
So through family dysfunctions, family abuse, physically drug abuse, a very violent environment, which ultimately led to me running away from home. And
at what age?
The first time I was put out of my house was at the age of 15. And I found myself in the streets, and I found myself connecting with older men in the streets. These adults who lived a particular street life. And people in the neighborhood was familiar with my family and some of the different struggles that they encountered for us with drug abuse and physical abuse towards me and towards each other. So it was not like it was not known. Yeah, and so me connecting with the older men in the streets eventually turned into me being like a mule being used in the drug trade. And, you know, with me, I only seen it as though, you know, I'm hanging out with this known guy in the street who has a reputation. And so if he has a reputation, I'll have a reputation. It allowed me also to connect in terms of what I thought then was what I was missing and lacking was that love, you know, feeling accepted.
So things can happen in just a moment that change a life. What was the crime that sent you to prison?
So the crime that sent me to prison, my participation in selling crack cocaine led to confrontations with other drug dealers, and which led to arguments about, you know, where you can and cannot sell drugs, which led to physical altercations, which ultimately led to guns, shootings, shooting at each other. My crime is the crime of getting into a shootout and shooting and killing an innocent bystander. And as a result of that, I was arrested.
And you were how old?
I was 16 years of age.
And when you were sentenced, ultimately, and you heard the judge pronounce this sentence, do you remember your feelings and what you were thinking?
Understanding at 16 years of age and being faced with a natural life without parole sentence, being charged with first-degree murder, I did not comprehend what all was taking place, nor could I have feelings or emotions about what was going on. I was young, very immature. My IQ was very low. In fact, I was already a dropout in terms of being in school. So all of the dynamics that was going on, I couldn't comprehend and I didn't understand. So having the feelings, having the emotions, making the connection, it just was something that as a 16-year-old, it was impossible to do.
How long until it did hit you?
It didn't hit me until maybe like 5 years into my sentence, because there is a process called maturity that has to take place. And maturity just doesn't show up at your door and say, okay, it's time for you to, you know, be grown. You have to learn.
How did you handle things when you were in the prison system? What was your approach?
So when I entered the Michigan Department of Corrections, I was 17 years of age. The thing that saved me from becoming prey was the street mentality that I had became accustomed to at a young age. Many of the other young 17 and 16-year-olds that was with me, they was preyed upon. And so they was raped. Some committed suicide or tried to commit suicide. And what saved me is that street mentality. And because I knew what to look for and how to maneuver in this new prison environment, it allowed me to make it, you know, day in and night out.
And then what led you to books and to learning? What changed?
So after, I would say, the first 5 years of being defiant, because when you're young, you are defiant. When you're immature, you are defiant.
No one can tell you anything.
Exactly. And so after getting into trouble, and at the end of the day, I was the only one that was in trouble. And I said, enough is enough. I'm tired of being used. I'm tired of always being in trouble. I need to do something. I need to start learning. And so I started attending programs then that was being offered by the prison. And I start also attending programs that other prisoners, older prisoners, was running for prisoners. And my interest in the older prisoners that was running programs for prisoners is what had me really, you know, interested and curious, and it set the pace for me to, you know, be involved with my change.
Let's talk about forgiveness. The man you killed, how did you deal with forgiveness of yourself even for doing this? What was that process like?
Forgiveness is very easy to tell somebody that you're sorry. I mean, those could just be words on the surface. But forgiveness is something that you have to learn, because you have to truly be able to connect with what you did. You have to identify with why you did it, and you cannot go back to the return of doing it again. So that's what forgiveness is about. And it holds the meaning because you get what you did. You understand the value of whatever it was that created the conditions or situations or circumstances to bring about, you know, seeking forgiveness. It took time. I was able to forgive myself. I was able to seek the forgiveness of the person that I killed, and want to have that conversation with my victim's family and friends, and to talk to others about forgiveness and what that looked like. That is a path. That is a journey that you are on and that you take. It's just not something that, you know, happens or comes to you overnight.
What was the process as far as victims' family members responding to you and to your release?
So my victim's daughter and mother was the ones who had to be contacted, and they had to be made aware of the changes of the law. And so my victim's daughter and victim's mothers were notified, and my victim's daughter was in opposition in the beginning of me being released because of the anger and hate that she held towards me, because she grew up without a father, and she watched other girls have their fathers in their life, in their lives, and she was unable to have hers. And so she was able to have a conversation with me through the help of my counsel. And throughout the conversation, she wanted to know what happened. And I explained to her what happened. And she wanted to better understand what was going on. What kind of family was I raised in? And I explained to her those things. And after having those conversations, she wanted to know about who I am now. And I was able to tell her who I am now. And not even 20 minutes into the conversation, she just said, "I forgive you." And you're talking about one of the most greatest feelings in the world. That was the most greatest feeling in the world, to be forgiven by your victim's daughter and your victim's mother. I mean, that's better than a release from prison, because the victim is saying, "I'm no longer a victim. I'm no longer victimized." So the burden and weight has been lifted. So when people talk about from a position of a legislator or prosecutor, what the victims feel or how the victims are going to be hurt, there are victim family members or friends who support the release of juveniles back into our society, back into our communities. Yet there are some who do not. But again, I would say to those who do not, I'm just suggesting that there's no need to live in a society or a world where you're willing to it be an eye for an eye or a tooth for a tooth. It should be, we live in a moral society, and we want to come together to see how we can bring an end to this. We need to come together to see how we can help these youth mature, develop and grow, and understand the connection that they should have to community. They understand the connection they should have to self, which is basically respect for self and respect for community, respect for others. Those type of conversations should come up out, I think, a real good discussion between, you know, a victim or victims organizations and those who committed crimes. because this is the type of society. We live in a civilized society that's full of good morals and good values and good principles. We do not live in a society where we just throw human life away.
Well, Antonio, we all want to wish you the very best in your studies and as you rebuild your life. And thank you for sharing your story with us.
Thank you.
That's Antonio Espri, one of only a handful of Michigan's so-called juvenile lifers who, thanks to the U.S. Supreme Court, has been given a second chance. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The debate over what we as residents of Michigan are officially called may soon be over. Headed to Governor Snyder's desk is a package of recently passed bills that modernizes the 1913 statute creating the Michigan Historical Commission. In those bills, the term Michiganians has been struck out in favor of Michigander. That got Stateside producer Mike Blank thinking, perhaps it's time for a whole new word to describe us.
And now, a minute with Mike.
To many, this may seem trivial, but I don't think it should be the priority of our elected leaders to be making laws about how you or I can describe ourselves as residents of our great state. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm extremely proud to be from Michigan. However, there is one aspect of being from Michigan which I find quite disconcerting, being called a Michigander. There's just something about this particular word that leaves me with a gut feeling similar to binging on Coney Islands. In other words, gross. Plus, I abhor geese, particularly the border hopping type, which shall remain nameless, that turn lawns and parks into a minefield of feces on a regular basis. So, Governor Snyder and my fellow residents of Michigan, I implore you all. We need a new moniker that we all can be proud of. And this is when it gets kind of difficult. Due to Michigan's syllable and sound structure, there's not a lot of linguistic clay to work with. There's the second standby, Michiganian, but that's the same amount of syllables as saying, I'm from Michigan. Don't believe me? Go ahead, count it out. I did. There's Michiganers, but that rhymes with beginners and implies the state is full of novices. Michiganites or Mishites, kind of sounds like a bacterium-laden Old Testament rock formation. Michiganist could work, but doesn't roll off the tongue nicely and could subconsciously make folks feel bad for not flossing their teeth regularly. Mishy, that's kind of nice, sort of friendly, but it also sounds like a derogatory term used by Ohioans. For example, I was planning on going to Toledo, but it's so close to the state line that that sick, mishy stench of corn, oil, soybeans, and fresh water really affects my asthma. So that leaves me with my personal favorite, Michiganier. With our nautical connections and being comprised of two great peninsulas, it's perfect. And who wouldn't want to go by the hard-working, swashbuckling, salt-of-the-earth term, Michiganier? M-I-C... See, I told you we need a new name. H-I-G. G, Michigander is a terrible name. A-N-E-E-R. Michiganier.
Michiganier!
Michiganier.
Michiganier!
With a name like that, we can hold our heads up
high.
High, high,
high!
So come along and join with me and end the Michigander tyranny.
M-I-C-H-I-G-A-N-E-E-R.
Michiganier!
And that is our show for today, Michiganeers. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.